The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages. I am Roger B. This is Locked and Loaded, and you are listening to America's Web Radio. Now, usually we're going to talk about, I have some interesting stuff about pistols and guns and new developments in that, but first I'm going to do a little bit of crime and politics, because that's always fun to see when people don't realize that when you release criminals back into the world very quickly, they tend to do the same thing they were doing that got them in there in the first place. And apparently, Colorado has an issue of keeping enough of their juveniles in captivity to keep them from smash and grabbing burglaries throughout the year. Colorado Springs has had trouble this year. It says many of the crimes are committed by juveniles who were let loose quickly and sent home until their first court hearing. So they don't even stay in captivity until the first court hearing. They're sent home right afterwards and they stay at home. And a lot of these homes that they go back to don't respect the law, don't have any disciplinary control over these juveniles or anything. And it's just crazy because he's saying they're having a lot of smash and grab robberies. They said gun stores and pawn shops are the primary targets of the over 40 smash and grab burglaries they've had in the surrounding areas. And 19 juveniles in connection with the crimes, with 11 other suspects arrested. It's just, and only 4 of them are still in custody out of the 19 that they took, or they found, or was able to prosecute. So this is crazy. And these people get out, and they come and do the exact same thing again and again and again. It's just like in parts of California and New York, where they have a limit on what you can steal from a place at $950. And no one actually goes and checks to make sure they're not taking anything that's over that value. You know, unless you're going into an expensive electronics or jewelry store and making a grand theft attempt here, going into a cosmetic store or a Walmart and just bag loading a bunch of stuff and walking out with it, and they're not being prosecuted, so there's no reason for them to stop. And they're finding that out in Colorado Springs quickly. You let these people go, turn them around in a revolving door justice system, they're going to get out and do the same thing. The punishment was not enough of a deterrent to keep them from doing it yet again. And that's where we are, which is kind of nuts, because you think you want crime to stop, and the way to make crime stop is to offer a punishment for breaking the law. There's got to be consequences for doing something wrong to make you want to stop doing it. If you get rewarded by getting to keep all your stolen stuff and getting right back onto the street within the day, getting to go do it again, and maybe not get caught this time, so you don't even get delayed by a few hours. But he goes, apparently they're having issues with trying to have enough space to keep the juveniles in, because they had a 479-bed capacity on the juvenile detention center. And over the years, that cap has been cut by more than half, and now stands at 215 beds. So they can only hold 215 juvenile offenders, even though they started at 479. So they just have no place to keep these criminals, these juvenile criminals. And I understand, I mean, grabbing, shoplifting, basically smash and grab shoplifting is probably not a dangerous crime, but it does cost everybody who shops in that city. And people don't realize that, oh, these are underprivileged children. We need to let them do this and do that and do the other. It only contributes to them committing bigger and more expensive and more dangerous crimes in the future. If you don't stop the behavior while it's still controllable, it gets out of control very, very quickly. And they've had a 28% increase in juvenile arrests in the state from 2021 to 2023. So that's almost, you know, 28%. That's a quarter more juvenile arrests in the state. And the fact that they have half the number of beds that they started with means most of these juvenile offenders are not held for very long. And they have to basically weigh the crimes and see who they'd want to keep and who they wouldn't keep. And that's just not how, you know, crime and punishment should work. The punishment part is supposed to be the biggest deterrent to committing crimes. If not, if there was no punishment, people would commit crimes all the time. It'd be like the Purge 24/7. Now, granted, they're not doing this yet with violent crimes against people, but they are doing it with violent crimes for theft. I mean, a smash and grab costs companies thousands upon thousands of dollars. Even if the stuff they take is not worth thousands, the damage they cause to get the stuff is worth that. And they're just, it's difficult for them to prosecute them because they have no place to keep them. And the same thing's happening in big cities kind of all over the country. There's just no place to keep criminals, and they're just committing crimes over and over again. Especially, you see videos in New York City all the time, or San Francisco, where people just walk in, load a backpack full of whatever they're stealing with a mask on and a hat, and they walk out. Security guards don't stop them. The police can't do anything because they can't prove it's over the $950 limit. And I don't know what the limits are, I guess, on what you can do to somebody who does that. I don't know. It's just, I don't know that they can hurt and I don't know they can detain juveniles if they're doing that. Would they be allowed to? But it's kind of crazy. But they go back to their house that's not supportive, not law abiding, and they get treated like heroes because they stole a bunch of stuff for the family if they don't get caught. So it's just, and that's what we're doing. We're giving these criminals the right to steal things without any kind of punishment. And that just turns them into career criminals. Now, they may start off at smash and grabs. They may move up to more expensive crimes. And they may eventually turn to violence. So you're basically cultivating criminals by not stopping them at the source. It's just like with any kind of, with plant growth. You don't stop it when it's young and small. It's going to get worse. It's going to get out of control. It's going to be unable to be stopped. And these kids are going to become career criminals, and they won't have any place to put them either, and they'll turn them right back out into the streets, and they're committing crimes. And what that's going to do, anybody who shops at that store instantly pays more money now because they have to have higher insurance. They have to have more replacement glass, more replacement cabinets, cases, whatever it is that holds their products. They have to replace products more often without any profits being made, so the prices have to go up. And then the neighborhoods complain when these stores shut down and move out of their neighborhoods. It's like, you're causing this, and yet they're complaining about it. How come we don't have any stores like that here anymore? Why didn't they reopen that store? Because everyone was stealing from it, and it wasn't making a profit. If a store doesn't make a profit, it can't keep its doors open. It's that simple. And at some point, it gets to the point where they can't charge enough to make up for the crime that's happening. And when this happens, the store has to shut down or move to another area. They move to another area where there's less crime, and they can operate and make a profit. And a lot of these people go after the chain stores because they figure they have the most ability to absorb a lot of this stuff. But sometimes they go into independent stores, which they can't absorb thousands of dollars of losses every week or every month. They can't afford to do that, so they have to shut down. And that's all they can do. So be aware when you're out shopping, you see this and you think, oh, the poor kids, they don't have any way to get anything. They don't have any way to take care of themselves. Look at what they're stealing. If they were stealing groceries, I'd say, you know what? They're hungry. That we can work with. But them smashing and grabbing new sneakers or grabbing makeup or whatever it is I saw, that is not in order to feed yourself or have a survival instinct. That's just because you want stuff that you're not willing to work for. And if these people don't take the initiative and try and stop this soon, it's going to get out of hand. And we will become a country of criminals. And there'll be no stopping it at that point. The big cities are already like that. A lot of the stores just can't afford to stay open in some of these cities, or they raise the prices so high, then everybody complains about inflation and high prices. Well, you know what? Your city governments are allowing this to happen. Your state governments are allowing this to happen. There's no other way to explain this. So if you don't know or you don't understand what's happening here, look at it from a perspective. If someone steals from you over and over and over again, you can't afford to keep replacing everything if you're not making money on it or it's not serving its purpose. So next time you see somebody stealing stuff, no, it's costing you money. They're taking that money right out of your pocket if you shop at that store. So there's no other way to fix that other than stop it at the source, or at least make it illegal so security guards can detain and stop possible offenders, even if they are juveniles. They need to be stopped. They need to be detained. They need to be fined. They need to have a cost to doing the crime. You know, they say, don't do the crime if you can't do the time. Well, here, there's no time. There's no issue. There's no deterrent at all. So they can do it. They can afford it. As silly as that sounds, they can actually afford to commit the crime because it doesn't cost them anything. They don't have time to do. All right. Well, one more thing we need to worry about these days. Hopefully smaller cities and counties and stuff will keep that stuff under control and not let it get as bad as it is in some of these big cities. It is crazy how they people just stand by and watch as these thieves come in and run rampant through their stores, taking bags and bags of stuff, just dragging it out of the store, and they don't do anything to stop them. You know, it's insane. Anyway, okay, so now we're going to move on to, there's an issue. It's funny because most government facilities or schools or wherever you may go to vote, wherever that happens, most polling places do not allow you to have guns on your person. You cannot carry in most polling places. So maybe they think you can't exercise more than one right at a time. If you're exercising your right to carry, you cannot exercise your right to vote, which is skeptical at best because there actually is no right to vote in the Constitution. But if you have an ability to vote, they don't want you to take your ability to vote and have it with your ability to keep and bear arms. So, and it's funny because you wonder why would this be a problem for most people? And most people it's not, but you know what? Polling places are often targets for criminal elements, for terrorist activities. If they can blow up polling places, that would be one thing that would just horrify people, keep them from going to vote. If you knew you were unsafe at a polling place, you'd be less likely to go vote. So they're basically deterring people from voting by not allowing them to defend themselves. And you wonder, how often does this actually happen? Okay, this is a quick story we're going to get into. An Afghan national allowed into the U.S. shortly after the Harris-Biden administration's chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. He was charged Tuesday with plotting a terrorist-inspired Election Day terror attack. He came into the United States on September 9th, 2021, just weeks after the Taliban regained control of Afghanistan and all the U.S. troops had left the country. And they granted, sanctuary to more than 70,000 Afghani nationals to enter the U.S. after they exit Afghanistan. Now, a lot of these guys some of them are still ISIS terrorists. And you're going to just allow them to come into our country with no vetting whatsoever other than, I want to be a refugee. I want to come to America. And Biden-Harris administration, let me not mix that up yet, was letting these people in by the tens of thousands. And it allows them to receive 2 years of legal status in the U.S. with the ability to apply for extension. So basically, they're giving these people pretty much unlimited time to come here and do whatever they want. Now, I don't know that they could acquire guns legally, but anywhere in the world, you can acquire guns pretty much wherever you want if you know how to go about it. There's very few countries on the planet that you can't go and find a gun if you want one. And this guy was plotting an attack on an election polling place. So he was going to stop. He was going to do whatever he could to make elections in this country. He was going to terrorize people into not voting. Fortunately, they stopped him before this happened. And he wasn't stopped by a gun-free zone sign either. He was stopped by law enforcement who got wind of the attack, did the research, found out he was planning this, and they managed to take him into custody before he was able to, I guess, carry out his evil plan. And he had been acquiring guns illegally to plan this terrorist attack. So he was ready. He was ready to do this, but fortunately they caught him before he was able to do it. But, you know, that's why you wonder, okay, if someone was there, pulled guns on people in a polling place, and nobody in the polling place is able to defend themselves or the other people there, you're making it a wide open area for people to be victims of crime. Whether it's terrorism, whether it's robbery, whatever it is, you're giving these criminals advantages over regular citizens. And this is something I'm so tired of. It's insane that we have these people coming here, disrespecting our laws, disrespecting what we stand for, and we allow them to come into the country with no vetting other than, it's an Afghani refugee. We use them in their country, and now we're just going to let them all come here without any vetting. Half the people we were in Afghanistan with were enemies of the United States. And you have to vet these people to know who was and who wasn't. But they just had a blanket number of people coming in, supposedly as refugees, to escape the Afghani situation. And I'm sorry, but, you know, if you want to have a country that's not run by terrorists, then one, don't vote them in as they do in the Gaza Strip. They voted in their terrorist form of government. It was a free election. They voted the terrorists into power, and then they complained, saying, oh, we're innocent bystanders. You're not so innocent. If you vote for terrorism, then by God, you have to live with it. And if one of the side effects of living with terrorism means that you get shot, you get bombed, you get blown up in your house or your neighborhood because you allowed a terrorist regime to run your country, then you know what? You voted for it, you pay for it. That's what it's going to cost you. Yeah, you put your family in danger by allowing terrorists to run your country. And I'm sorry, there's no other way to put it. There are countries all over the world that have fought for their own independence, fought against terrorist regimes, yet these people seem to have no interest in defending their own country, in defending their own rights, into keeping things civilized in their own country. They don't care enough to do it. They're not willing to risk it, but they want other people to come in and fight for them to get them freedom. But they're not willing to fight for their own freedom. If they're not willing to put up, then they need to shut up and deal with what they've got. And when their schools get blown up because terrorists are hoarding bombs there, then you know what? So what? You didn't report it. You didn't try and stop it. You didn't do anything to help fix it. So therefore, you deal with what happens with it. I'm sorry. I can't get over this. This idea that there's all these innocent people in war zones. It does happen. But when these innocent, supposedly innocent people vote to allow terrorists to run their country, they're not innocent anymore. It's like the difference between a moderate terrorist and an extremist terrorist. The moderate terrorist will hold your feet down while the extreme terrorist will cut your head off. That's the difference. You're dealing with two ends of the same stick, two wings on the same bird. You can't have a terrorist-run country and have people there who are innocent civilians. Because if they really wanted to, they would either try and fight their way out of it, or they would move. Now, I know you say it's difficult to get out of some of these countries. It may be difficult, but not impossible. If you really want to get out of it, then you would find a way out. If you really want to improve your station in life, you will find a way to live where terrorists aren't running your country or running your neighborhoods or your states or whatever it happens to be. If you're complaining about this, then you need to do something about it. And I know it is difficult. It's dangerous. But, you know, at some point, if you want independence, you're going to have to stand up and fight for it on your own. You can't expect other countries to risk their young men and women to fight for you. If you're not willing to fight for it for yourself, then you don't deserve it. Then you deserve to live in a terrorist society, terrorist country, run by the people who don't respect you, who will kill you if you're caught doing anything against their ideology. You know what? That's who you voted for. Suck it up. I'm sorry, but there's no other way to put it. I mean, Americans fought for their independence. They continue to fight for other people's independence, and these people won't even fight for their own independence. They won't fight for their own right to life. They won't fight for a life without terrorism. They won't even help people fighting to eliminate the terrorists. They won't help them to do it. Very few. Most of them that help get paid huge amounts of money. So it's not just because they want to be free. It's not just because they want to be live in a terrorist-free society. It's because they want the money, and they're willing to risk their lives for the money, but they're not willing to risk their lives for their family's future or their state's future or their country's future, which is why we should stop helping any terrorist organization that allows terrorists to exist where they put them in office, where they're not willing to do something to help get them out. You know, it's insane that we keep doing this. We are not the world's police. Now, understand, if you're in an oppressed country where there's people trying to take it over and you need help to repel the people, the terrorists from you, that's a different story. But if you vote to allow terrorists to run your country, you don't deserve any kind of help or protection. You need to stand up and put a little skin in the game. You need to stand up and decide, you know what? I don't want to be ruled by terrorists anymore. I'm going to vote a different way next time. I'm going to work on trying to get these terrorists thrown out of office or thrown out of my country, or I'm going to leave my country. I can't stay here if it's going to be run by terrorists. So consider that. Anybody, if you're out there and you live under an oppressive terrorist rule, I understand you may have family, you may have a job, you may have things there that you don't want to leave, but you have to decide what's worth more to you, living in freedom or living under a terrorist society with a job or living in your country under a terrorist society. Would you rather start over fresh in another country and be free or at least more free? So, sorry, can't get into that. Can't get into that enough, but that's what happens. All right. Now, as I talked about earlier, I was going to cover some interesting stuff about technology and things that have coming in that have basically changed the way we think about certain types of weapons. So there's one thing I wanted to start with, and this is compensators on weapons. Now, weapons have been compensated for ages. You know, they cut slots in the barrels. They build some sort of device that screws on the end of it. And what this helps do, it helps reduce the felt recoil. Now, in most rifles, not considered a question whether or not you want one. Any big rifle will probably have some sort of compensator, some sort of recoil-reducing device built onto the end of the barrel or threaded onto the end of the barrel to make it more pleasant to shoot, easier to shoot for longer periods of time, or just reduce, you know, potential recoil on your body. And this is something that's been accepted for years in rifles. In fact, a lot of rifle manufacturers have been making built-on compensators for years on a lot of their weapons. And a lot of people, like I say, I know semi-automatic rifles, a lot of those military style have some sort of muzzle device on them. Now, a lot of them are just flash hiders, which are to keep the flash from being easily recognizable in low light or minimal light to keep you from being pinpointed. But a lot of them have compensators on them, which helps reduce the recoil when firing. And most people don't seem to have a problem with rifle compensators. But it's a good idea because rifles can generate a lot more recoil force than a pistol. And it helps maintain accuracy, helps maintain comfort during shooting. And that's always going to be a big factor. And because the fact rifles are so much larger than pistols, an extra couple, 3 inches here and there on a rifle is not going to make as much of a difference as it is on a pistol. Because you put a big, huge compensator on a pistol, muzzle, a screw-on muzzle device on a pistol, it's going to offset the weight of it. It's going to make it harder to carry, harder to conceal. It might make it impossible to carry on a daily basis. But now what they're coming up with is there are pistols that are being made. The compensators are becoming much more common now. And it's funny because there's points on both sides. Historically, the only pistols that were compensated were larger caliber weapons, usually for hunting, heavy revolvers, bolt action pistols that fired rifle cartridges or something equivalent. These were compensated pistols because they were large, they were unwieldy, they were not exactly considered, they weren't considered carry weapons. They were strictly hunting weapons or purpose-driven weapons. In fact, I remember silhouette shooting was a big deal back in the 70s and 80s, and a lot of it was done by guys with pistols who had compensators put on their pistols, whether they were bolt-action pistols or just very large revolver pistol cartridges. They built compensators on to help them to be more comfortable to shoot. But the compensator added several inches onto the ends of the barrel, which made them a little more unwieldy, especially on a carry gun. You want to add 2 or 3 inches onto the barrel of a carry gun, that's kind of crazy. That's going to make it way more. It's going to make it much harder to put in a holster, makes it harder to conceal. So this was all that was compensated for a while was these big, heavy, large hunting weapons or possibly purpose-built competition weapons. Now, they have scaled that up a little bit, and they built competition guns, you know, usually semi-automatic, and they got into the more tactical side of semi-automatic pistols and adding compensators to those. Now, these guys are guys who shoot very rapidly, usually with reduced loads, so they can shoot faster and faster, and the compensator just helps keep them on target and be able to increase their rate of fire. Now, you may wonder, this would be a great idea for everybody, but initially the compensators were rather large, and they made the pistols almost to the point of being unconcealable most of the time. And then, of course, they built these full open guns with recoil pads on the bottom of the magazines. They had magazine wells to funnel the magazine into the bottom of the pistol easier. They had thumb rests, and they had compensators. And the compensators were to help get fast firing going to where you would not have as much recoil to be able to control the weapon a lot easier, even during fast fire. And fast fire is what competition is all about. You're at a certain speed. You want to keep that speed as fast as possible, as accurate as possible. And with a compensator, it would keep the barrel focused on the target a lot better than trying to do it without any help. It just made it that much better. And these are usually considered open class pistols if they are in competition. And these open class pistols have no restrictions as to size, as to convenience, as to any resemblance of an actual manufactured production, standard production gun. These are purpose-built weapons. And they have to take advantage of every possible feature that could shave fractions of seconds off their competitive times. So these people were the first person to use the compensators on a regular basis, were these people who were competing. And they would be in competitions with other people, and that compensator, that couple tenths of a second during firing a magazine, could make the difference between winning and losing. And that's how these came down. Now, the idea of a tactical pistol came from people in competition also. But then they thought, you know, I'm so used to this compensated pistol, maybe I should have a carry gun that has a compensator on it and be able to use that as an everyday carry gun. That way my carry gun and my competition gun can be similar. I'm used to the features. I know where the slide release is. I know where the safety is. I know how the trigger works. And all these transferred over into a tactical pistol, started in tactical competitions. But then there were people who said, you know, I'm so used to that weapon, I want something as similar as possible for my personal carry gun. They wanted to have something that they could carry that had all the same features as their competition gun, only smaller, more compact, more easy to conceal, more easy to carry. And all this got funneled down into regular carry guns, everyday weapons. So now, early on, most compensated weapons were just a matter of carving slots in the side of the barrel, and they carved slots in the side of the slides to allow the gas to escape. And that was all a compensator was. And basically what it is, it filled the area between the slide and the barrel with hot gases, bits of unburned powder, lead buildup and stuff would get in the openings of the barrel. And they were very basic versions of a compensator. And it also made for a bigger cleanup because all this gas and everything would escape into the actual gun itself and build up there and cause issues. And they had to be kept extremely clean, so it wasn't as good for a tactical weapon that wasn't cleaned after every single competition. And also, they had a lot more muzzle flash with these early compensated guns because they weren't even compensated. It's more like just, I guess it was like a recoil-reducing device, having slots cut in the barrel and in the slide. It would bleed off the gas, try and aim it away from the top of the gun to avoid from causing the muzzle flash to cause problems at night. That was another reason why a lot of guns were not compensated initially, because having flames and gas escape the front of your gun in a nighttime or low-light situation can mess up your night vision completely and make your second or third shot nearly impossible to take because you're flash-blinded. So then they worked on building compensators that had several different chambers that would limit the amount of flash that escaped to no more than the flash that escaped from the end of the barrel. Also, cartridges had a lot to do with it too, because people were loading cartridges at different rates. Originally, there were so many different calibers of handgun, and most of them were not built to burn the powder in a standard cartridge in 4 to 5 inches of barrel. Like a 40 Smith & Wesson was a hot cartridge. It was powerful, but it also had a lot of unburned powder coming out the end of the barrel. Same with the 10 millimeter. Now the 45 was actually built to be a little slower round, and as long as you're not running plus P's and stuff like that, you can get almost a complete burn out of a 5-inch barrel on a 45 ACP. But you get into 10 millimeters, 40 Smith & Wessons, and any kind of oddball cartridge like that, not oddball cartridges like that, but there were oddball cartridges that were used, like small neck-down pistol cartridges, like the 357 SIG. Having the neck-down cartridge led to a lot more velocity, but that also led to more powder being sent out the barrel unburned. And having a compensator would help keep the recoil down also. If you've ever fired a 40 caliber versus a 9mm, you'll know the 40 caliber has a lot more recoil than does a standard 9mm. And that's because it is a more powerful cartridge. It's loaded a lot hotter. It has a higher pressure that it operates at. So using this, it was going to make the muzzle flash greater. It was going to make more recoil. So they backed them down. And now that most handguns now, I would say most defensive and tactical handguns are chambered in a 9mm at least. So that's something you have to consider. And with a 9mm, it's a lot easier to run it through a compensator and not have a lot of unburned powder coming out the end. So, and a lot of the cartridges are designed to burn powder in a smaller length of barrel. All right, I'm going to come back and get to the rest of this, and we're going to get into optics today also. All right, I am Roger B. This is Locked and Loaded, and you're listening to America's Web Radio.
Hi, I'm Joe DeLapp. I've been on the National Fundraising Board at St. Jude for 20 years. On September 28th, we're holding our Walk Run fundraiser to help the sick kids at St. Jude. Go online to stjude.org/walkrun. That's stjude.org/walkrun. And look for St. Jude Walk Run in your area. Or if you'd like, you can join my fundraiser supporting the Walk Run this year. You can go to walkrun.stjude.org/DELAPP. That's DELAPP. That's walkrun.stjude.org/DELAPP. Thank you.
If you want the truth about politics, medicine, weapons, classic cars, and more, you'll want to tune in to America's Web Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite shows live at www.americaswebradio.com or on demand on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. That's www.americaswebradio.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Roger B. This is Locked and Loaded, and we're back on America's Web Radio. Here we go. As I was talking about before we left, we're talking about compensated pistols and how they have become much more mainstream, much more readily available on a lot smaller weapons than ever before. And one thing about having a smaller weapon that's compensated, it makes up for having a smaller weapon because smaller weapons have less weight. Less weight transitions or translates to more recoil with the same cartridge being fired, while a larger handgun with more weight will absorb more recoil on its own without compensation. So with the 9mm becoming a much more standard handgun cartridge than ever before, it's going to make sense that now these will be the ones that can be compensated. And you can have them compensated and be small enough to where they'll be effective for a carry gun or a everyday carry piece. So that's something you have to consider. Now, also, multi-chambered compensators have become very popular now. And what that does is keep the muzzle flash issue that the early compensators had from becoming a problem. They run through several ports in a separate compensator that is built onto the end of a barrel on a separate platform, basically. So basically, your compensator is built onto the end of the barrel. The slide is independent of the compensator in most cases, the newest ones. So the slide recoils without the compensator moving. The compensator is attached to that front of the barrel, which also gives you more accuracy because it stays attached to the barrel. And with the multi-chambers, it keeps the muzzle flash down to an absolute minimum, gives you the compensation you want, the reduced recoil, keeps the muzzle flip down by keeping gases directed outward and pulling the weapon forward actually a little bit. The slots are cut to where they aim slightly backwards to pull the gun forwards to keep the recoil from causing loss of sight picture. So a compensated pistol should be able to shoot much faster at a more accurate pace than any non-compensated pistol shooting the same cartridge in the same weight handgun. And if you guys are thinking about compensators, you're thinking about the old screw-on devices, like they used to have threaded barrels, and they'd screw a compensator on, and it looked like a cheap muzzle device that you screw on an AR-15 or something. Yeah, we've come a long way since then. And a lot of these compensators have multiple port chambers, in order to keep the compensation at a maximum and the muzzle flash to a minimum. Now, there's still going to be some muzzle flash from these because there's muzzle flash anytime a bullet escapes from any area where it's being focused. Out the end of the barrel, you'll see muzzle flash at the end of a barrel of a non-compensated weapon as well. And having these chambers on the end to help compensate it just gives you a little bit less muzzle flip, a little less recoil pushing back, and enables you to stay on target and get fast, repeatable backup shots with a lot less effort. So now if you decide to go out and look for one of these, check them out. And if you can rent one first, try it and see if the compensation works for you. There are most higher-end manufacturers have come out with what they call carry comps or carry weapons that are compensated to help reduce the recoil and reduce the effort it takes to fire fast, on target, repeatedly to make your shooting that much better. And what this does is gives you a better chance if you ever need to draw your weapon in defense of yourself, your family, your property, your friends, gives you a better chance against criminals to fire faster, more accurately, and have a better shot at this. And everybody wants every advantage they can take when it comes to defending your life or the life of your loved ones. You want to have the most advantages possible. You want to do everything you have to do to be able to keep that at a maximum. You want to have every advantage possible when you're trying to defend your life or the life of your family members. So a compensator may be a way to go, especially if you're recoil sensitive. A lot of people don't handle recoil very well, especially smaller frame people or people with, sensitivity to that kind of stuff. They may find it's much more pleasant to shoot a gun that has a compensator built on with multi-ports in order to get faster follow-up shots, less, you won't be as, startled by the gun moving as much. It cuts down on movement of the pistol, and you can actually increase your firing rate considerably by considering getting some sort of a tactical weapon or carry weapon that has a compensator built in. Now, most manufacturers now are offering this. I'm going to try and think of a list here. I know SIG offers these. I know Canic offers these. I believe Smith & Wesson offers these. Trying to think who else. There's probably a bunch more that I can't think of right now. And if you're sitting at home thinking, oh, I know. What about this guy? Send those to me, roger@americaswebradio.com. That's roger@americaswebradio.com. And I will come up with a more comprehensive list if I get any suggestions to go on. So that's something to consider. And also, most compensators now are built, I would say it's hard to describe this with words. I mean, they're built into the end of the barrel. They're attached to the end of the barrel, but they're also part of the slide. So it doesn't change the size of the overall weapon. So if you're carrying a 4.5-inch 1911 style weapon, the compensator is built on, takes up the last half inch of the slide and the barrel, and it fits in a standard holster. Because you want to be able to carry these as easy as possible. You don't want to have a different holster for different guns, even though they're the same weapon you're shooting. You don't want to have a comped one and a non-comped one and have them not fit in the same holster. They're making these now to where they fit in a standard holster, in a standard style holster, standard size holster, so you don't have to do anything special to be able to carry these weapons. And some of the smaller ones especially, the compensated smaller ones, make it much easier because smaller weapons tend to recoil more anyway. Why not take advantage of the possibility of a compensator to keep that smaller weapon steadied, controlled under recoil, and give you better, faster follow-up shots? Always a good idea. And it doesn't take much to learn how to shoot with a compensator. It's just, besides from a possibility of a little more muzzle flash, there's not much to it. The sights still line up the same, trigger still works the same, all the features on the gun still work the same. It just has a little bit less recoil and requires a little bit more cleaning if you go through a long shooting session. Alright, the other thing I wanted to get to today was optics on carry guns. Now, this is still a subject that's been hotly debated, but I think it's to the point now where this has become more commonplace. Originally, when optics were on handguns, they were not very reliable. They were not very rugged. They didn't hold up very well against recoil. And most of them were put on, again, this started out on big hunting weapons. Large revolvers, bolt-action pistols, things that people use for hunting had optics on them. And most of the original ones were just basically a scope built with long eye relief that you put on a large pistol. They were kind of awkward, and they were kind of sensitive, too. They were very much more fragile than some of the optics built today. Our optics quality has gotten extremely good in the last probably decade or two, because now everything can be cut with computer-controlled equipment, so precision that used to require hand-fitting, hours of hand-fitting by people working in workshops, can now be done with a computer-controlled cutting machine in a fraction of the time it used to cost to make these. I'd be willing to say that you have moderately priced optics today that are equivalent to the finest optics that were available 30 or 40 years ago. We have come that far with computer-controlled polishing, cutting, all that stuff on the optics. And being able to cut more precisely means the lenses can be made smaller, they're better glass quality, so they get more light transmission. And this is the kind of thing that kind of increased a lot when you had competition guns again. You know, you had these hunting weapons, the competition weapons. These are the early days of optics. These are the only guys who ran them. Because, I mean, the scopes of old were, they were large. They were kind of bulky. Now, they were pretty reliable, but not 100% the way that some of them are now. Some were pretty fragile. Now, the technology advanced so much. And also, we've come into a different realm of optics. The fact of the matter is almost all optics prior to probably 20 or 30 years ago were magnified of some sort. There wasn't a whole lot available that wasn't magnified in some way. And on a carry gun, you can't always use optic magnification because you're shooting at closer ranges. You cannot afford to have to hunt for a target through a scope that magnifies things. So you had to have optics built with no magnification and still have a point of aim that was going to be accurate, reliable, rugged, durable, that you could actually carry. And if it got banged around a little bit, it was not going to lose its zero. It was going to hold its zero regardless of how you treated it up to a point. But most of them could be treated just like any iron sight gun and still retain that ruggedness, that reliability factor, the durability that the latest pistol optics have been built with. Because, I mean, say prior, it was tough. They were much more fragile, much more difficult to build to where if you tapped it or banged it on something, it knocked it out of alignment. The new ones, they're built super tight. They attach really well onto slides of semi-automatic weapons and onto the rails of revolvers and such. And also, the advent of rifle caliber pistols, they have become so much more popular now that pistol braces are available. And with that, optics are almost a standard on most rifle caliber pistols because you have the capability of being out at long range without having to, you know, without having to sacrifice, you know, your compactability. You have folding braces and whatnot that could help you shoot a rifle caliber pistol so much more accurately. And you have a choice. Some are magnified, some are not. Plus, with the scope technology, as it's gotten better, it used to be scopes would run, you know, 3-9 was pretty standard. But to get down below 3X was difficult for most manufacturers. It required very precise cutting, very precise mounting, and having lenses that multiple lenses that were large and heavy, and it was difficult to come up with that. Now, a 1X scope is not that difficult to get. It functions well. And also, then they came out with the red dot. Now, the red dot is a unique sight in its own. It's usually fairly small. It projects with either a laser or an LED light. It projects a dot onto the field of view and the screen that's encased in metal or plastic. And as you look down the pistol barrel, you line up this red or green or blue dot or optic sight with your target. And it's all in the same plane. because focusing on a scope of magnification while you're trying to fire a pistol is difficult because your eyes have to focus on the target out there and it has to focus on the scope internals, which is very difficult. You had to have two eyes focusing on two different things to make them work. But with the advent of red dot, or what they call red dots or dot sighting, that all went away. All of a sudden, everything was in the same plane. You kept both eyes open. You could see the dot. You could see your target all at one time. And the dots were, they became rugged and reliable. In fact, probably one of the very first practical pistol optics is probably the Trijicon RMR. Now, if you haven't heard of this, I don't know where you've been living, but if you're interested in pistol sights, the Trijicon RMR is probably one of the earliest reliable pistol sights that have ever been made. In fact, RMR stands for Ruggedized Miniature Reflex Sight. So the RMR sight, Ruggedized Miniature Reflex. And it was built to be durable enough to put on an everyday pistol without being fragile, without being knocked out of alignment. It was built to mount solidly to the top of a gun. Now, what they did is Trijicon developed a plate or a mounting pattern which lets you put screws directly through the sight into the slide of the weapon, so it's secured directly to the slide. And usually it was slotted or cut to where the sight would fall in between two, a notched area, and be supported front and back by the actual slide metal itself by falling into a pre-cut slot. And then you put the screws in, secure those, and the RMR was born, and it was magnificent. It was able to maintain zero. It was able to be a very rugged sight, very durable. It was, I would say it's almost as durable and reliable as iron sights. Almost. Don't come after me for this and say, oh no, well, you can't run out of batteries in that. Well, Trijicon fixed that too by using tritium powered optics. So basically it didn't matter if you had batteries or not. This sight was going to function because it was powered by radioactivity in the form of tritium. But now also, The LED lights and LED lasers that a lot of these use will function for tens of thousands of hours on one battery. So yeah, if you're concerned about battery life, change your battery once every 6 months or a year, depending on how often you need to. And most of the time, it's a small button battery, and the very best reflex sights can be changed without removing the sight from the gun. That's something they learned after the first ones were built. They had to remove the sight to change the battery, and of course that changed your zero and everything. You had to start over and get a new zero. Now they've got them where you can change the batteries without removing the sight from the weapon, so it retains its zero. You change the battery out, and the batteries last for 10,000 hours, 5,000 hours, whatever it is. And you realize actual shooting time is a fraction of that. So you actually have days and days and days upon usage in these sights without ever have to even consider replacing a battery. And that's kind of what you want. You want it to be reliable. You want it to not be thought about as far as, you don't want to have to think about your battery and your sight. Oh, is it good? Is it not good? It's good for 10,000 hours. I've only had it for 6 months. I'm sure it's fine. You know, they use very little power. Now, some of them, the latest thing now is they run solar panels on some of these optic sights. And these solar panels will recharge or run the, some of them will run the sight on solar energy. So if you're in daylight, that sight will be on, you'll be able to use it, and you don't have to worry about your battery life. It's never going to use the battery at that point. It's got solar power doing it. Now, they don't have, from what I know, they don't have rechargeable batteries powered by solar yet. So it either runs off the solar or it runs off the battery, but it doesn't recharge the battery in the sight. That'll probably be the next step. As they get to rechargeable batteries that can take small amounts of power from solar cells and actually retain some of that power and hold charge for the next time it's in use, that'll be helpful too. And I guess, I don't know, I haven't kept up enough to know, but a rechargeable sight is something that could be an option in the future too. But again, rechargeable batteries don't usually last as long as standard batteries, but they're building the sight so much more efficient now. They use so much less power. In fact, one feature that I really like about a couple sites I have is the auto off feature. If it stays on for more than a few minutes and doesn't get moved at all, the site automatically turns itself off. And the latest ones, they call them shake to wake. Now, what shake to wake means is you take that site, you give it some sort of motion, and it will turn on the site automatically. You don't have to worry about pushing buttons or anything to get started. Once you set it up, it goes to sleep, basically. You shake it, it wakes itself up, and it's ready to go. The light's on, you're ready to get onto target and start shooting. So the technology has gotten so much better in the last few years. And it's beyond anything we've seen. Now, like I said, with the Trijicon, the RMR, their reputation was built by providing the military with rifle optics. And after they proved that rifle optics can be as durable as iron sights, a lot of places adopted either RMRs or some sort of reflex sight or red dot sight to use for standard weapons, especially at reasonably close ranges. Anything you don't need a scope for, the red dot sight was beautiful. And they claim they can use these out to 100 to 200 yards. Of course, that's going to depend on how big the dot is. Most dots are several MOA, which means they cover 2 to 3 inches of target at 100 yards, which for most pistols, that's not a problem. Most pistol shooting takes place at 25 yards or less. Occasionally, you get the guy striving for 50-yard shots. And in reality, in gunfights, most shots take place in under 7 yards or 22 feet. So that's something to consider also. But the fact that some of these will shake to wake, which means you don't have to worry about them putting it away with the sight still on. You shake it, or you, as the act of drawing it out of the holster, will activate the sight, turn it on, and enable you to fire with a red dot. Now, the thing about red dots that's a little odd, even though they're durable and reliable, they do take a different sort of training to get used to shooting them. Transitioning between an iron sight and a red dot sight does take some time. It's not something that's done instantly. Even though it's on the same plane, which means you're looking at your target and the dot, and they're both in the same plane of sight. You don't have to worry about focusing on iron sights and focusing on a target in the distance, which is what makes pistol shooting somewhat more difficult, or any sight shooting with iron sights. You have to focus on the target and the sights. One is it's a couple inches or several feet away. The other one's it potentially hundreds of yards away. And you have to be able to focus on both at the same time. Now, if you got old eyes like I do, that becomes more and more difficult to do. It's harder to focus on two things at once, especially at different distances. That's something you'd have to learn to do. Now, with a red dot, it puts it all in the same plane, so you don't have to worry about multiple focusing points. However, you're looking through a little window, and you have to line up that sight onto your target. With iron sights, you just get them close, you start firing. With a red dot, if you don't see the red dot, you don't know where it's aimed, and you won't be able to hit anything within that window if the red dot's not appearing in the window. Now, ideally, the red dot will be where that bullet hits, whether the red dot's in the center of the screen or whether it's to the left or right or down low. Wherever the red dot is in the screen, that's where the bullet should hit if the red dot's properly built and rugged enough, dependable enough to hold up to recoil and everything like that. You put that dot on your target, you've pulled the trigger, that dot is where that pistol cartridge will hit. That's where the bullet strikes. So it does take some time to get adjustment to that, because normally you're used to focusing on two planes at the same time, the close up on the sights and the far away on the target. Here they're all in one, so it gives you an advantage as far as focusing goes. Now, with these optics, though, the pistol optics, I think it's still best to probably stick with one of the more reliable manufacturers on these, because there's a lot of inexpensive copies that are coming in and just not built to hold up to repeated recoil in such a small, on a small weapon such as a pistol. Because pistols create a lot of recoil up and down, back and forth, and oftentimes that's even harder on a sight than being on a rifle. And also, with the way these sights mount, there's several different, I guess, standardized plates. They haven't really come to a, there's no standardized mounting system yet. There are a few that have more popularity than others, and manufacturers are trying to copy the most popular versions of a mounting plate to make them easiest to transition from pistol to pistol to make one sight fit as many weapons as possible. But a lot of the pistols will come with multiple adaptive plates to make them be able to hold the biggest variety of red dot sights or reflex sights. So be aware of this. When you buy the gun, make sure it has multiple adapter plates, or you buy the gun cut for a particular sight that you want to use. And the RMR is probably one of the most popular ones because it was one of the first, but there are other patterns out there. So be aware when you're buying a weapon that has an optics cutout on it, make sure it either comes with the plates or can be adapted to the plates to run the type of sight that you want to run. It's not standardized yet. Like rifle scopes have Picatinny rails, pretty much are the standard now. Now, granted, there are still older bolt-action hunting rifles which have Weaver mounts and things like that that slip into a little slot. They pivot over and the screw holds it in place. But most scopes now on rifles are held by Picatinny rails. And even some of the pistol sights, especially on smaller guns where it's not as important to be concealable. Like on my, I have a Ruger 22 pistol. The Mark, I think it's a Mark 3 or Mark 4, whatever it is. Mark 3, I think. And it has a Picatinny rail on it to run an optic. So that way I can run an optic anything that I'm out on a standard Picatinny rail. And it's a little more bulky. It's a little larger than some of the compact sights that fit on combat handguns. The ones that fit on combat handguns usually fit into recessed sight slot on the back of the slide, and it gets in there and it stays there and it hopefully doesn't move too much. There's metal in front and behind the sight to keep it from moving forward and backwards, and there's usually at least 2 to 4 screws to hold the sight in place on the slot cut in the back of the weapon. What this does is give you a really sturdy mount. It gives you a very reliable mounting system. And it holds zero very well because it's got the ruggedness to hold up to the fire of the pistol. But still be aware when you're buying an optic and an optic mount pistol, make sure you have the availability to use the optic you want on the pistol you want, because a lot of times this is just something that takes a little bit of time to adapt to, and there's no standardized mount for pistols yet. They're getting there. They've got a few that are more popular than others and more standard than others. But unfortunately, when they first came out, a lot of companies were trying to make their own mounting plates for different sights, working with different manufacturers to make theirs compatible with some sights, but not with others. So while that's still working its way out or working its way in, there's going to be some flexibility in what sights will mount on what guns. Now, a lot of guns will come with multiple adapter plates, and you have to find the right adapter plate to run on your particular weapon to run the type of sight that you want to run. So it's a lot more tricky than putting a rifle sight on. So be aware of that, and if you get a chance to try it, try it. It does take getting used to. It does take a little bit different skill to use an optic mounted on a pistol. But if you get a chance to do it, highly recommend it. It'll be a skill that will be worth having. All right, I am Roger B., and this is Locked and Loaded on America's Web Radio.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.